You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week for Dear Science, we are joined in studio by our expert, Professor Alan Blackman.
What happened to the news?
What happened to the news? It's Morning Glory News is...
Bye-bye.
Oh, what? Yeah. Oh, shit, nobody told me. Guys, I was hanging out for the news. It's, my goodness.
It's been absent
for at least 2 weeks, obviously.
Yeah, for a little bit now.
Sorry
to catch up on that. Know. There you go.
Bit of a surprise.
Oh, dear. Anyway, thank you to MOTAT, as we talked about MOTAT right then, for inviting me to the grand unveiling of their new set up out there, which was very impressive. So I urge all you listeners to go out there and look at it all. It's fabulous stuff. There's this wonderful interactive periodic table out there, which, you know, caught my eye. So, you know.
Big and exciting stuff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what have we got in science this week about more?
Okay. Well, how do you make a thing? How do you make a living thing, I guess, is the big question here. What do you use as your blueprint, I guess? And that thing is the genome, essentially. So that contains essentially all of the information that you're going to need in order to construct whatever it is that you want to construct. And we've only been able to sequence the genome, last 10, 20 years or so. When did the human genome come out? Early 2000s or something, I think, somewhere around about that. And that's all come with advances in technology, as I guess things do. And so now we have this ability, we can basically obtain the genome of any species living or indeed dead, as long as we can sort of get our hands on some DNA of that particular thing. And so with this in mind, there's a bunch of scientists at Harvard in the USA and Japan, Germany and Canada, and notably not New Zealand, who have sequenced the genome of the little bush mower. Okay, now I have to admit I didn't know as much about the little bush mower as I should. But they used to live in mostly the North Island, apparently, and some of the South Island as well. And they were usually around 50 to 90 centimetres in height and weighed up to around about 30-odd kilograms. So sort of a big turkey. Something like that. Okay.
Not the sort of giant mower we might be used to thinking.
No. So they were one of their not necessarily descendants, but relatives, shall we say. Yeah. Okay. And so the reason that this was done in those particular countries and not New Zealand was that they had a skeleton there at the Royal Ontario Museum in Canada. And what they did was to take a toe bone from this skeleton, and they got some DNA out of that, and then they managed to sequence the genome from that. So that's why I guess we weren't involved, because the sample was already offshore. So sadly, obviously, the mower, the little bush mower, is extinct now. It lived in New Zealand for millions of years, you know, millions of years, and sadly no longer. But who's to know what's going to happen in the future now that we have got essentially the blueprint for making one?
So Jurassic Park, those birds.
Yeah. Well, look, it is going to happen. It just is. I mean, it's humanity's natural curiosity. They're going to do it one day when the technology allows.
And I think it's probably safest to start on birds instead of
dinosaurs. No, yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're absolutely right there. Yeah. So what can they tell from this? Well, again, it's amazing the sort of things that they can tell just from the sequence of base pairs. That's all that it is. It's just a sequence of A, T, G, C, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They could tell that these birds could see in the ultraviolet, for example, okay, which was very good for capturing prey that were busy hiding. And they also can figure out that they were very sensitive to bitter foods. Now, how the heck they know that, I really don't know. And again, I'm not sure whether this comes from direct analysis of the genome, or I can't see how it can, but they're sort of putting an upper limit on the number of little bush mower that there was sort of at any one time. And so they reckon that roughly the population could have got up to around about 250,000 at any one time. Mm. And what they can tell is what their nearest relatives genetically are and how long ago it is since they sort of diverged from their ancestors. And so they're saying around about 70-odd million years ago they diverged from the rhea and the ostrich. Okay, so they are related to those. And then their closest living relative, in fact, about 53 million years ago, they diverged from the tinamous, okay, which... Ooh. There are a bunch of birds in Central America and Mexico, in fact. And this is, it's not flightless, but it doesn't like to fly, apparently. So if you challenge it. Yeah, exactly. It sort of runs away rather than flies away. It only flies if it absolutely has to. So not absolutely flightless, but, you know, sort of possibly losing the ability maybe to fly.
Not really keen on it.
And that's what they thought of. Yeah, exactly. And that's what they think about the little bush mower as well, that they'd shown previous to this that the mower had the necessary genes to be able to form wings, okay, but that these genes mutated over time as they became flightless and eventually they lost the need for these. So the little bush mower actually didn't have any wings. They were actually wingless, okay? And so kind of like the kiwi, I guess. The kiwi hasn't got wings, has it? So,
No.
And, you know, so this is a major advance, I guess, in New Zealand taxonomy, if you want to call it that, I suppose. And, you know, as I say, one day somewhere down the track, somebody is going to take this and they're probably going to create a little bush mower in the lab. And that's going to have all sorts of ethical considerations, I would say. All sorts.
Little guys, not so little guys wandering around, maybe.
Yeah, so I thought that was pretty interesting. And let's see where this leads, because there's still an awful lot of information that can be obtained from the genome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what have we got here about protein folding?
Well, again, this we're going to seriously get into ethics here. Mm-hmm. And this is the ethics, I guess, of probably science for profit. So let's start at the beginning. Okay. So let's talk about proteins. So proteins are something that you've all heard of. Okay. Mm-hmm. And chemically, there's protons and proteins. So proteins are very, very large molecules, okay? Very large molecules, and they are made from very small molecules, amino acids. And these are little molecules, and basically you stick those together and you make yourself a protein, okay? And so there's about 20, 21, depending on who you believe, amino acids that we can make proteins out of. So there's a huge variety of different possible proteins that you can get out there through the different arrangements of these 21 amino acids. Right. Now, once we've made a protein, now, you know, these proteins could be made up of thousands, tens of thousands of amino acids. So you're looking at a very, very long chain, essentially, which we can think of a protein as. But the protein itself doesn't exist as a very, very long chain. It folds, okay? And it folds in very, very particular ways to give itself a very, very particular shape, which enables it to carry out a variety of functions in living systems. Okay, so these molecules are, you know, they do stuff, basically. Okay, and the stuff that they do and the stuff that they can do is very, very dependent on the way that they fold. Okay, so they can have interactions with big molecules, other big molecules like DNA and RNA and stuff like that, very, very specific interactions, again, which will come down to the way that they fold. Or they can interact with small molecules. They can act as catalysts, for example, to get small molecules reacting. And again, that really relies on their overall shape, the way that they fold, and that the way that it folds can create little sort of clefts where little molecules can go into, and then they react and then they get spat out at the end of it. So they're precisely defined shapes and clefts and everything, which all comes back to the way that they fold. Now, so we can think about, for example, drugs acting. Okay, so how do drugs act? Drugs are extremely specific, okay, in their actions. And, or you'd like them to be anyway, that's, you know, most of them are. And so, again, they're going to be binding with proteins in a lot of cases in a particular way, in a, you know, definite particular way to carry out a particular process in the body that's going to, you know, make you well. And simplifying things horribly there, but that's, yeah, that's the way that it works, okay? So if you have got a way of predicting how proteins are going to fold, then that's going to give you a big advantage in the area of things like drug discovery and stuff like that, okay? And indeed just how living systems work, okay? And that's really, really important stuff. So Google's computer scientists have been at this, obviously. They've looked at this question, how do these molecules fold? And so they released an AI program called AlphaFold 2, a few years ago now, and they published that in Nature, which is, you know, a very, very high-ranking scientific journal. And when they published that, they also published the code of this. So it's an AI program, essentially. They published the code, and essentially that meant that anybody could then download the code, and away they go. They could utilize this to do with whatever they want, basically. Right. Okay. So they've just released the updated version of this, AlphaFold 3, okay? And they've also published this in Nature, but this time they didn't include the code.
Ooh.
Okay. And so they're putting sort of, I guess you'd call it restrictions on it, I suppose, that you can only sort of do 10 structures a day, that you can't download the program per se. You can only access it through a web server, so you can only run it, you know, online, essentially. And yeah, so this has led to people thinking, well, you know, hang on a minute, this is, and apparently, you know, it's a big advance, you know, it's, so the predictions it can now make are way better than its previous version. So this is, you know, this is big stuff. And therefore, potentially, this is probably worth an awful lot of money,
yeah,
for the reasons that I mentioned before. So this has got a few people riled up. And so a bunch of scientists have got together and they've written a letter to Nature and said, look, hey, what's the story? You know, the previous version, it was basically, you know, free to air, essentially. You could do whatever you wanted with it. And in this case, no, you can't. And they are sort of saying, well, you know, this might violate Nature's terms and conditions, as it were, where basically, you know, if you're publishing something in Nature, you're just sort of publishing the whole darn thing. But yeah, then Nature then wrote a editorial response to that and then sort of said, well, you know, if you look very carefully in our terms and conditions, we do reserve the right to not have to publish anything in consultation with the people who've done the work. So if, you know, if they deem that there could be some, I guess, monetary advantage that could come out of this, then, you know, if they make it free to everybody, then they could lose that advantage. And so, you know, Nature is sort of saying, well, you know, this is in our terms and conditions, but, you know, we see that this is a topic of conversation that we need to have a discussion about this because it's going to be very, very important going forward. So, and it's sort of been left up in the air there. So this was sort of the Nature editorial response. And so essentially the status quo continues. So it has been published. The code still hasn't been published. From the best of my knowledge, the restrictions are still there on usage and stuff like that. And, you know, the question then comes, right, so this could make an enormous difference to humanity, basically. This could be a huge, huge advance. Is it fair that it's in the hands of a private company? And, you know, on the plus side, well, it probably is because they did the work. They funded it all and everything. So, you know, why shouldn't they own it? On the minus side, you know, is the rest of humanity, basically. So there's an ethical question for you out there. If any of you have the answer,
yeah,
you can, in fact, write to Nature because they are sort of wanting ideas on this. They're wanting responses and stuff. So if you go and read the editorial in Nature, see what you think. If you think you've got something to contribute, then by all means, drop them a line and see what they say.
And that'll be up on our BCast for Dear Science later on today.
Okay.
And then moving on Promethium discovery making us rewrite chemistry textbooks.
Well, and that was the
the headline.
That was the headline.
Right.
Yeah, I wouldn't quite go that far, but it's clickbait, you know.
Right.
You've got to get people clicking on the story and everything. But it is quite nice. So there is an element, or well, the two elements actually, out there that should exist on Earth and don't. Okay. So these are elements number 43, technetium, and element number 61, promethium. Mm. And these sit in amongst all the other elements on the periodic table, which we do have on planet Earth. But these guys, at very best, there's tiny, tiny, tiny amounts
right.
on Earth at any one time. And the reason is that both of them, all of their isotopes are radioactive, and they've all got relatively short half-lives,
right,
which means that since the Earth was created, they've all decayed away, basically. So if there was any on Earth originally, it's all decayed away. Yeah. So in order to use either technetium or promethium, we basically have to make it. And that is not a simple process, so that involves just ridiculous amounts of money and gear and stuff like that. And there's only a few places in the world that can essentially do this. And promethium in particular, so its longest half-life is 17.7 years, okay? Which means that if you've got a sample of it, it's all gone in 177 years. It'll all be gone, okay? So if you're going to work with this stuff, you've got to work with it pretty quickly. Mm. Nobody really has because, again, it's difficult to make, but they've just made the first report of the first compound containing promethium. So I had to include that because I'm a chemist and it's a bit geeky, but, you know. And it's not going to rewrite the chemistry textbooks, but it's a great addition to chemistry here because now they can figure out what promethium's properties are and, in particular, how big its compounds are and how much distance there is between promethium and other atoms. And that's very, very important knowledge to know, and now we kind of know it. As I said, not going to change the textbooks, but a nice piece of work anyway. So
And we're making it do stuff.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, that may be to come. You know, it just depends how much interest there is in this, because in order to do anything with this, you've got to go to a place that can make it, and that's not cheap at all. So
maybe expect big things in the future of promethium.
Well, certainly more than there's been in the past anyway, yeah.
Right,
yeah, absolutely.
Fans finally catching their big train. All right, thank you, Ellen, for coming in this week. Thank you, Moshat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Moshat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.